alcoholic. And can you hear me? I don't want you to miss a word. You never know what God's doing, you know? I was thinking that when I was sitting over talking to Debbie. You don't know what God's doing, you know? God turns the sound off, He turns the sound on, you know? I heard Tom Eye speak once, and Tom was explaining that these speaker meetings, that's what we do here to give ourselves a break from the real recovery that's happening out in the hallways and when we're sitting together. And I turned and I looked at people then. Everyone was talking to each other. And I didn't see anybody going crazy. I mean, a few people may have had to work your program a little bit and be patient for, you know, a couple of minutes, and then your program would kick in or something like that, and you could have peace right where you're at, no matter what's going on around us, no matter if the sound's working or the sound isn't working. And if it didn't work at all, we would have all just moved closer, you know, and we would have done it anyway. And big deal. It doesn't, you know, it just isn't that big a deal. I've got a lot of friends here this weekend. I want to thank the committee, by the way. Thank you for inviting me here and having me here. It's good to see Linda and Jerry, who I love, and Earl, who has forgotten more about AA than I'll ever know, and Karen. I've heard Karen a couple of times. I don't know Karen very well, but I know her sponsor, and I love him, and he's always meant a very great deal to me. I was listening to a CD of Dr. Paul on the way up. And Dr. Paul was talking about a guy that they were having this big banquet deal, and a fellow was supposed to do the prayer, you know, before the banquet, and he didn't show up. So they turned and they asked another guy. They said, "We need you to get up and do the prayer," and turn around and walked away. And this guy goes, "Oh no, you know, what am I going to say?" And he got a piece of paper and a pencil, and he started writing this down, you know, and wrote down all this stuff, you know, in 15 minutes really quick so we could get up and do this prayer. And he got up there and he goes, "God," and everybody said the Serenity Prayer and just broke for the food, you know. Thank you. Two words, free and food. Don't say those around alcoholics, you know. I drove down from Maryland. I live in Florida. I've been in a retreat this week. And, you know, I don't know where I was at. We go all these places. I don't know where I'm. I get there. I don't know where I'm at, you know. I don't know what's nearby or anything. But I drove in late at night, and I got up the next morning. My roommate was sitting there. And I pulled the curtains open. I said, "Look at that. There's a big lake out there." And he said, "Lee, that's the Chesapeake Bay." A little more significant than a lake, you know. I didn't know where I was at. And so, you know, I made my way down there and had an opportunity to sit and to, you know, just sit there, you know, and look at that and to think about that, you know, and to be there. And it was in the mornings, it was so still and quiet. And I would look and I just, you know, it's like that's all there is. But I would see a fish move or jump and a fin would make these little waves and stuff. And it became really apparent to me that there was so much right there just underneath the top of that water, that there was life there, and it was an abundance of life, and there was more life happening just beneath the water where I couldn't see than I could ever imagine or ever know. And I was sitting there, and you know, and I would get restless, and I would say, almost jump up, and I'd say, "No, I'm going to wait. I'm going to wait another 2 minutes, because God, I want you to take me a little further than I've ever been before, and I'm going to fight this restlessness, and I'm going to sit here just a little bit more." And I was sitting there, and it came to me that water, it was like the new people, you know. And I know there's a lot of new people here because we come here. And I know how it was when I was new, because no one in the world looked at me like there was anything to me at all. And there wasn't much to me apparently. But we know something very different here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We know that you new people, just under the surface, there's life. And there's life that will be revealed as you keep coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. An abundance of life and an abundance of purpose. You know, and if I'd gotten up 2 minutes earlier, I wouldn't have seen that. How many people are here with less than 1 year of sobriety? Are there any people relative? Yeah, a bunch of people. We're glad you're here. You're in the right place, and please keep coming. I don't know if you know it or not, but you never ever have to drink again. Let me be the first one to tell you that. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I monkeyed around with Alcoholics Anonymous for a little while. But one day I came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never wanted to leave ever again. And I had never had a drink since that day. And I don't think I'll ever have to drink again as long as I keep coming and doing the things that people tell me to do here. My sobriety date is November the 20th, 1984. And I didn't pick that day. I would have picked a better day than that one. I would have picked Christmas or the 4th of July or something like that, you know. But we don't get to do that here. You don't get to pick your sobriety date, you know. I picked a bunch of them. They just didn't take. This is a great program. I can't wait to hear to get through so I can start enjoying it. I was talking to Don C. Out in the hall, we were looking at the program, and Don was reading over the program and said, "Hey, look, there's a disco dance tomorrow night." I said, "Yeah, that'd be good." And he goes, "Oh, no. It says here it's all gay." You guys hadn't read your programs. The DJ is named Al Gay. Don remembers when black shirts were in style the first time. They're back. Don's thinking, "Boy, I'm glad I saved all those shirts." David A. said there's three kinds of alcoholics: drinking alcoholic, sober alcoholic, and dead alcoholic. And I know that the only reason I'm here today is because I'm sober, you know. And today I am a sober alcoholic. And there's no doubt in my mind that the only reason that I'm sober is because of a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried everything. I tried it all. When I drank alcohol, I could not control the amount of alcohol that I would drink. And when that caused me enough trouble, I quit forever. And I couldn't quit. And I was licked. And Alcoholics Anonymous, the program, has given me a complete package. It's made full provision for me. And I know that I can stay sober today. And you new people, don't ever give up. Don't ever keep coming. If you're breathing, there's hope for you. And if you keep coming and you keep doing this deal, you can be sober too. I was talking to a guy once, and he asked me, "What do you do in that time, between that space of time, between coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and when the obsession is removed?" And, you know, and I just said right off the top of my head, well, you go to a lot of meetings, you call people every chance you get, you read the book, you get a sponsor. But I thought about that later. I said, "Boy, that's a mean time, you know?" And I thought about it, and I said, that's the period of time that you determine whether or not you really want to be sober or not. And I know what it feels like to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and be in that space, and you just hang on no matter what. I had a thinking problem a long time before I had a drinking problem. The book says our main problem centers in our mind. I've been sober 16 years, and let me tell you this. My main problem still centers in my mind. And it can happen any minute, you know, any second. My earliest memories in life are like laying in bed at night when I was a kid, and I would have imaginary conversations with a kid at school, another child, and I would practice these conversations in an effort to try to fit in with others. I was so uncomfortable. I remember laying in bed at night, and I would say, "Well, I'll say this to so-and-so, and they'll say this back to me. And then I'll maybe say this back to them." And I would practice this. And when I would go to school the next day, I would try this out on somebody. And I would go to them and say, "Well, blah, 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 blah." And they would maybe give me the response that I'd hoped for. And then I would know what to say back to them again. And I don't ever remember a time in my life when I didn't feel less than, inferior to, or fearful of everything and everybody around me. I always felt that way. There was always some kid around that just seemed perfect in every way. The teachers all liked him. He would dress neat and nice and looked appropriate and say the right things. He always made good grades. He had blonde hair. I just hate this guy's guts, you know. I'd be mean to him every chance I got. I'd like to say I grew out of that, but I never did. When I was in junior high, in an effort to try to fit in with others, I played sports, and I was big so I could play sports. They used to tease me and tell me, "Lee, you're born on the 18th, 19th, and 20th of June." And I would, you know, I played football and basketball, and I ran track, and I played baseball, and I stayed busy all year long doing this in an effort to try to fit in with a group of people. And You know, and I made some accomplishments in these sporting activities. I came in fourth place in the 20-mile marathon once. My football team went all conference one year. I came in third place in a state event in a 440-yard dash. And despite these accomplishments, it didn't seem to make any difference at all. I would still feel unusual and uncomfortable. It was not sufficient to overcome this problem that I had with myself. When I was in high school, I became very interested in girls. I was about 15 years old, and I lived with my grandparents. My mother and father had a lot of problems. I've lived long enough to make a lot of the same mistakes. And today I understand it so much better than I did then. But I lived with my grandparents. In the little area we lived, there was a girl that lived nearby that I was just nuts about. And I would, you know, I'd be at school, and I knew I would see her at school. And I'd be talking to a buddy of mine, and we'd just be talking. And she would walk in the room right where we were at, you know. And she'd kind of just walk right over and kind of stand right next to me, you know. And out of the corner of my eye, I could see her arm, you know. I could see her skin. I could see her hair. I could smell her, you know. And my mind would start racing. I couldn't think. I couldn't breathe. I'd run out the door, you know. I couldn't stand to be in her presence, you know. And we would have dances after the ball games there in the gym. And I'd see her there at the dance. I'd say, there she is. You know, boy, look at her. And she's so good looking. I love her. And I'm going to ask her to dance, you know. And then I'm going to hold her in my arms. And I'm going to tell her I love her. And we're going to walk outside. And we're going to walk in the moonlight. And I'm going to kiss her, you know. And I know all this. And that song would end. And I would say, well, maybe after the next song, you know, I'd ask her to dance. And then that song would end. I'd say, well, maybe after the next one. And then some guy with blonde hair would walk over there and ask her to dance. Screw the whole thing up for me. And, you know, I'd be at home. And I would peep through the windows. I'd peep through the curtains. And I would see her drive up. And she was a couple years older than me. And she was a cheerleader. And she was beautiful. And she'd get out of the car with those pom-poms. And she'd run into the house, you know. And I'd see her. And I'd go, oh. I love her, and I'm going to tell her I love her, and it's going to be so great. And I would just sit and think this and think this and think this, and I could never approach her. I could never say anything to her. I couldn't even stand to think that she might think I thought of her at all. And, you know, I would still be like that today. I'm sure I would still be that same guy, thinking that way and being that inhibited today, except one day when my grandparents were gone, a wonderful and magical thing happened to me. A buddy of mine came over to our home with two bottles of Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill. And I drank one bottle, and he drank the other one. And in a matter of 10 minutes, I was standing out on the roof of my grandparents' house screaming out my declaration of love, you know, for this girl. All that fear was gone. You know, I felt like I was 10 foot tall and bulletproof, omnipotent. And that's the way I always wanted to feel. Alcohol took me immediately to where I wanted to be instantly, and I loved it. I loved it from the very get-go. And I stood up there on that roof, and I would just scream out, you make the sun shine, and the stars come up at night. And her and her family came outside, and they're standing there watching me and stuff, and I didn't care, you know, and I just screamed on and on and on, I love you. Yes, you. When my grandfather came home, he drug me off the roof and put me in bed, you know. And when I came out of that the next day, you know, I knew I'd found what I'd been looking for. You know, I knew I'd found the answer. And I made it a point to drink alcohol every opportunity I got after that. And we were still in school, you know. And my buddies and I, we would pool our lunch money on the way to school. You could get a case of Boone's Farm for $7.20. And we would start drinking on that immediately. And we'd keep it in the lockers under the seat of the car. And, you know, why wait until evening to feel so good? You know. And I drank a lot, and I loved it, and I thought it was a compliment. People would come to me and say, boy, you sure do drink a lot. And I'd say, oh, thank you. You know? And I immediately started having a lot of trouble. And you just don't get to drink that way and be in high school and not have a lot of problems. And, you know, I'd worry my grandmother. I'd just lay out all night, and I wouldn't come home. And it seems as though I had an unquenchable thirst for alcohol. I had an unquenchable thirst for alcohol from the very beginning. And along with that, it seems like my mind was obsessed with alcohol. I know when I was a little kid, I remember waking up in the mornings And my first thought would be, I'm going to meet my buddies. We're going to go to school. We're going to play sports, you know, in the afternoon after we do our lessons. And then I'm going to come home. I'm going to eat dinner. And I'm going to play basketball until dark. And that would be my first thoughts. But in a very short time, after having experienced what alcohol could provide me, you know, I'd wake up in the mornings. My first thought would be, I'm going to meet my buddies. We're going to pool our lunch money. And I would immediately have these thoughts. And, you know, I can look back today as a result of the education I've received here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can say I had an obsession almost from the very beginning, almost from the very get-go. And I would lay out for a couple days at a time, you know, and I'd worry my grandmother. And I'd come home. My grandmother would say, Lee, you know, where have you been? You know, why didn't you call us? We just want to know if you're alive or dead. You know, many times my grandmother we'd sit on the couch and she'd throw her arms around me and cry, and I'd say, that's it, Grandma, no more, you know, and I'd mean it. I'd say, it's those guys I'm hanging out with. It's their drinking's what's getting me drunk. And I'd see with those guys, you know, it's all going to be better, you know. Anyway, first day everything would be okay, second day everything would be okay. On that third day, I would be pacing the floor back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I walk outside, walk around the house 10 times, come back in. My grandmother would say, Lee, can I fix you a sandwich? Would you like something to eat? Are you hungry? I'd say, get off my back. Stop watching me. You're smothering me. You know, how do you ever expect me to have anything or go anywhere in life or my life to mean anything at all the way you treat me? And I'd just, boom, blow out the door. And I did not know that when I would leave that I would be heading toward a drink alcohol. I didn't know that. I was clueless. And I would drink. And alcohol would cure that madness. And I could have peace and comfort one more time. The guys I hung out with, oh, they wanted to drink the way I wanted to drink. And we would steal. And when I first started stealing, the boy didn't feel very good at all. I know the men in my family did not steal. That was not my example. The men in my family worked, held down jobs, and were responsible. But we would steal, and I didn't like it at all. But I learned to accept it. And still later, I just learned to love it. And I wanted to steal something from everybody. And when I was 16 years old, I was in juvenile court. My grandfather heard about that and ran down there and said, boy, we've got to help that kid, you know. And when I was 17 years old, I was in civil court. My grandfather heard about that and ran down there and said, oh, my God, what will the neighbors think? When I was 18 years old, I'd walk down the road where my grandparents lived. My grandfather would see me. He'd run inside the house, scream to my grandmother, oh, my God, you know, he's coming back. And he'd grab his tools and his guns and start locking those things up and hiding those. My grandmother would grab her purse and her jewelry, and by the time I would hit the door, she'd be clutching her purse to her like this. My grandfather would be standing with his arm over the portable television set. And that was the last place I would ever go. I would go there when I was just sick and tired and dirty. No place left to go. But I would go there because I knew my grandmother would feed me, and I could just try to regroup. I drank until I had to get sober. And I stayed sober until I had to get drunk. And that's the way it was for me. And I don't know why, at such a young age, that alcohol took over in my life like it did. I take a meeting every Wednesday night into a men's halfway facility. And there are guys that are 22 and 23 years old that were just like me. They've been drinking 7 or 8 years. And just they can tell my story verbatim in my drinking story. When I was 19 years old, I caught my first prison bit. I wasn't ready. I was clueless. I thought I was pretty tough. I had some fights in those alleys. But I was wrong, you know. I never talk about it very much. And I'm always concerned that one of my family might get a tape and hear me talk about that kind of stuff. But you know what? I was driving down here. I was thinking about it. I said, nobody in my family's in AA. You know, they don't ever hear these tapes. You know? And I was thinking, you know, that I might be doing a disservice to any young person here that might be using some of those alcohol substitutes and who might be romancing the idea of a life of crime. So this one time, I think I'll be a little more specific. They had a song written about this place, very popular in the late 60s and early 70s. There's a farm in Arkansas with some secrets in its floor. Well, one day the ground coughed up some roots wearing denim shirts and boots where they found all those bodies of those men. 2 weeks before I got there, guys had busted out of the hole and taken over the prison and had taken some of the Free World Guards hostage. They'd wrapped them in chains, were beating them. Finally, other inmates freed those guards and helped save their lives and got to help the guards and sheriffs and state troopers and all those old farmers with their rifles and shotguns to gain back control over the prison again. The Ollie staff facility, I've been in several. I've never seen anything like this before. They take a guy that's in there that had a lot of time, and they make a guard out of him and give him a rifle or a shotgun. And the ones who are a little too crazy for that, they'd give them clubs and make them floor walkers. Ever so often I'll hear some guy that's pretty tough say something like, if anybody down there ever messed with me, I'd just whip their butt. Well, guess what? That's not the game down there. And they weren't playing whip your butt. A compound with 2,500 men, 900 of whom will never get out, no matter what. The rules are different. Human life devalued to the price of a carton of cigarettes. 99 varieties of sexual predator on your heels day and night. The rules are different. Every day was a day filled with screams, blood splattered up on the wall, and somebody running down the hall screaming with his throat cut. And in the middle of that madness, I made a fantastic discovery. You could get anything you want in there. And alcohol does the same thing in there that it does out here. And I got it together with my partners, and that's how I spent my time. And it helped. It made that place endurable. And many, many, many times, I'd sit and say to myself, if I ever get out of this place, I'm going to get a job. If I ever get out of here, I'm going to go to work. I'm going to be the man that my grandfather is, and I'm going to make everybody proud of me. And I meant that with everything in me. And the day I got out, my grandparents came and picked me up. And I could not have been happier. I was filled with joy. We were driving down that old highway, and I remember looking down at the road, and I saw the stripes down the middle of the road, and I was thinking, what are those there for? What are those there for? And I couldn't remember what the stripes down the middle of the road meant. And it seemed like one thing after another like that was happening. And my second day out, I hooked up with a pint bottle of Jose Cuervo. 2 weeks later, I was with the same guys doing the same old things. And 2 months later, I was back in again. And you can take the next 12 years of my life and just stick them in the garbage can. Because I was in and out and in and out and in and out. Every time I got out of jail, I thought I was free. Every time I got out, I said, I'm never going back. I just want to be a regular guy. I just want to have a job, have a car, have some clothes, live somewhere, you know, go to school, have a girlfriend, what I thought anybody could have. But I'd get out and I'd take a drink, and I was back in there before I knew it, and I was absolutely clueless. Alcohol to me was not a problem. Alcohol helped. Alcohol would help me stay together. It helped me forget. It would help me pull together another day. I took a job on the river once in an effort to try to do something about my drinking. 30 days on, 15 days off. I made it 28 days. I wanted to kill everybody on that boat. I'd go into my quarters. I'd sleep with a pipe. I'd say, if anybody comes in here, I'll kill you. I'll kill you. And I jumped the boat at 28 days and, of course, got just as drunk as I could get. And I called those people back 2 weeks later and just begged them for that job, and they would not. Of course, they wouldn't give it to me. The people are always trying to help us. Someone suggested to me, Lee, what you need to do is get married. You find you the right woman, and she'll settle you down. And believe it or not, and I know this is really hard to imagine, and you'll really have to stretch your imagination here, but believe it or not, there are women who are looking for guys that don't have jobs or cars, drink a lot of alcohol, and sleep with pipes, you know. And I found me one of them. And she broke 13 pairs of glasses right off of my face the first 18 months we were married. And she'd never heard of Al-Anon. She was more like an alligator. You know, and I'd get a job. I'd say, I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it every day. I'm not going to miss a minute. I'm going to do it. And I'd fight my way in there every day, boy. And Friday would come. Oh, boy, now I can drink. And there's something special about Friday drinking, you know. And I'd start drinking. And I'd drag back in 2 or 3 days later again. You know, I'd get another job. And I'd, oh boy, I'm going to make it every day. I'm not going to miss a minute. I'm going to do it different this time. And then Wednesday, hump day, boy. And I'm not going in that bar to get drunk. I'm just going to have a couple. I've just got to unwind. And I'd have 1, 2, 3, and I'd never remember 4. And I'd drag back in 2 or 3 days later again. She wouldn't understand these things. I know one time I was speaking with her. I said, honey, I know I haven't been the best husband. But I want you to know one thing. I'll never abandon you, you know. So she packed all her stuff and left. They said, move. Go someplace else, Lee. Start over. I said, that's it. Happiness is Arkansas in the rearview mirror. And I went to Michigan. And I went to Oklahoma. And I went to New York. And I went to Texas. And I went down to Florida. And the first couple of times I moved, I really thought. I said, it'll be better when I get to Oklahoma. But the last couple of times I moved, I knew it wasn't going to be any better. I just had to get out of town. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in New York City. My wife had left. Most wives, when they leave, they move to the other side of town or in with their mothers or something like that. Well, she wasn't planning on coming back. And I found out where she was, and I called her up and just begged her, please, 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 you know. We can't throw away all this love. You know, we got all this love happening here. You know, when she would leave, I'd say, who cares? Who cares, you know? But in a couple of weeks, the rent would be due. I'd be hungry, you know. And I'd really start missing her. She said, Lee, if you come up here, you're going to have to do what I tell you to do. And I said, anything. Boy, I jumped in my car, and 23 hours later, I was in New York City. And I jumped out of the car and ran into the apartment building where she was at, and I saw her. I just grabbed her in my arms, and I was kissing her and hugging her. And I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. It's going to be great. We're going to be so happy. And she said, Lee, if you stay here, you're going to have to go to AA. I said, you rotten witch. How are we ever going to make it? With your attitude. That's how I got to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was in the basement of a church. I walked in, it was just like this. There were a guy standing up there speaking, and I looked at him. I knew he was a liar the second I saw him, because he had blonde hair. And I wouldn't listen to this guy at all, you know. But after the meeting, two men came over to me and started speaking with me and really tried to reach me. And they talked about their drinking. And they talked so openly, I opened up a little bit and shared about my drinking a little, you know. And all my life, for my family and everyone I'd ever known, all I ever heard was, Lee, we don't understand, we don't understand, we don't understand, we don't understand. And I was talking with this guy, and he stopped me. And he said, Lee, we understand. And I'd never heard anything like that before in my life. And it scared me when that guy said that. And I took a couple of steps back, and I listened to this guy talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. He said that he was working. And that his family, they were together and they were happy. And all these wonderful, 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 wonderful things about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I told this guy, things have got to get better for me because they just cannot get any worse. And I was wrong. And I did not know that this was a progressive illness and that it always gets worse. I moved down to Florida in an effort to start over, get a fresh start. I got a job. It lasted about 2 weeks. That was about my max at that time. They just didn't understand why I was in the bathroom 8 o'clock in the morning drunk and puking. They did not understand me. The last 3 years of my drinking, I know it's only by the grace of God that I'm here at all. I cannot tell you how many times emergency vehicles came out. I have a hazy memory of flashing blue lights or red lights, people picking me up off the ground, my head being busted open, or police trying to straighten me out somehow. The last 3 years of my drinking, I tried everything that anyone suggested or I could think of. I know one time I checked into a hospital. I went to a hospital where there was a treatment center, just begged these people to take me in there and to do something for me. I didn't have a nickel's worth of insurance. They took me anyway. And 3 days later, I was kicking that nurse's desk and cussing her out, and you better let me out of here right now. And I walked straight out the door and got just as drunk as I could get. My wife and I went to a minister who prayed for us and counseled with us. We went to this big, huge crusade deal. We went 3 nights in a row. And at the end of each one of those services, they would say, if anybody needs God's help, God wants to help you, if you come down here and pray with anyone down here, that we know that God can help you. And I would make that trip from the back of the top balcony each night down to the front, and I'd pray with anybody that would pray with me. I wasn't trying to fool my wife or con anybody. I meant business. I knew I needed help, but I was drunk in a very short time anyway. I went to see a psychiatrist. I paid her $55. I told her the truth. I told her everything. I told her about the violence in our home. I told her about my drinking. I told her about my criminal activity. God, everybody knows you don't tell them that stuff. She said, it's going to be okay. You just keep coming. Call me. It's going to be all right. I'll see you next week. I walked out the door. I just heard clunk, that deadbolt. I probably scared that woman to death. She probably prayed more that hour than she had in a long, long time. My last really bad drunk, I came to on the living room floor. I'd pushed the television set through the window. There was glass all over the floor. My wife came back to get some more of her things. And I was trying to talk with her and reason with her and trying to get her to stay. But she had had it. And as she was leaving, she reached into her purse and she took out a little piece of notebook paper and just zinged it to me. And I unfolded a little piece of notebook paper, and what it was a prayer. Someone had gotten a pencil and written a prayer down and given it to my wife. And for the next 2 weeks, I just sat in that apartment. I'd read that prayer over and over and over and over and over again. I did not know where to go, and I did not know where to turn. It was 2 weeks after she left that I was captured again and wound up in Seminole County Jail down there in Central Florida. And I was separated from alcohol. And I was sick. And I was very, very, very sick. And every day they'd take me out and ram me on more charges and all that kind of stuff. I had charges in front of 5 judges. Very often we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, unwanted, unwelcome, anywhere. I was not unwanted. I was wanted. I was wanted in Orange County, Seminole County, Volusia County, New York, Arkansas, Missouri. Were very interested in me. I was a pretty interesting guy. One of my sentencings, judge leaned over the bench and said, I've just sentenced you to every year I can give you. And I'd give you more if I could. And you are despicable. And when I got back to my cell, I found a dictionary. And I looked that word up, despicable. It said, worthy of being despised. And I said, I know that. I've known that all my life. You know, I didn't know anything at all about being through with alcohol. But I knew one thing, that I was through with me. I'd had all me I could stand. And I couldn't stand another second of me. And I'd think, why was I born? Why do I even exist? You know, why live? I don't fit in anywhere. I'm not close to another human being. You know, I'm not good for myself or anybody else. Why even live? My grandparents, every thought they had in life, every move they made was in some kind of effort to try to make me happy, and they could not make me happy. My wife, every thought she had, every move she made in life was in some effort to try to make me happy. And she could not make me happy. Every thought I had, every move I made in life, was in some effort to try to make me happy. And I could not make me happy. And I thought life meant nothing, it wasn't going anywhere, and what's the use anyway? I heard there were meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous there available in the jail. And remembering the understanding I'd once found it. Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I'd just go and investigate Alcoholics Anonymous. And a man came to a jail. That's what happened to me. A man came to a jail. You know, I was at the International Convention. We were talking about that. You know, and I thought it was very interesting. They were talking about reaching Ukraine and reaching Russia, and the work they do in Japan, and all these places that AA has never been. I want to tell you, you don't have to go to Japan or Russia or the Ukraine to reach people that have never heard Alcoholics Anonymous. 2 miles from my home, there's a halfway house. They did not have a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there were men there that had never been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You want to be a pioneer in AA? You don't have to go to Russia or the Ukraine. Jerry was an AA member. Jerry had never been in jail. He's just a man that wanted to take a meeting to men or women that couldn't go to a meeting themselves. So I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just went week after week after week after week after week. I did not know if AA was for me or not, but I was certainly looking for something. Jerry would bring a guy in, and Jerry would get up and he'd talk a little bit, and then he would introduce a fellow. And he would get up and he would share, and he'd tell his story. He'd talk about his drinking, and he'd talk about a solution he found in Alcoholics Anonymous. They shipped me over to Orange County Jail, get some charges over there. Boy, I couldn't wait to get those. And I got over there, and they said they had a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, well, I'll go to that meeting. And I went to that meeting. And when I got there, it was a black guy. He was up telling his story. And now this is the fellow that had done time, serious time. And he really got my attention. And I was listening to this guy, and he was talking about Alcoholics Anonymous and one day at a time. And he was talking about how he didn't have to drink today and that he had a disease, you know, all this kind of stuff. Now this guy had the book Alcoholics Anonymous with him. And as he spoke, he would just wave the book over his head like this. And I would look at that book. I'd say, my God, that's a big book, you know. They'll never get me to read that big book. The next day they asked if anybody wanted to go to the library. And I said, I'll go to the library. And I wasn't thinking anything at all, you know. I wasn't a big library kind of guy. We didn't hang out at libraries. And I wasn't thinking anything. I just get out of the cell, you know. And I said, yeah, I'll go. And I went to the library. And what it is just a big room full of books. And you go in. And for no reason, I turned to the left. And I walked right up to the books. And right at the end of my nose was the book. Alcoholics Anonymous. And hopelessness makes this a very exciting book. Alcoholism, losing and failing and doing everything but dying, makes the book Alcoholics Anonymous very exciting reading. And I took this book and I went back to my cell and I opened it up and I saw my life. It was just like the lights came on. And I was reading in the third chapter, and I saw two paragraphs about a jaywalker. And I said, this is me, this is me, this is me, this is me. And I continued reading through the book, and I came to page 63, and I found a prayer that I'd set in a dark apartment, and read over and over and over and over again. And when I saw that prayer, it seemed like God himself was speaking to me, you know. You know, I'd been going to meetings for 5 months. And I was looking through a little corner of glass, and I could see a little triangle shape just inches wide of blue sky. And I was looking through the glass, and it just hit me, just out of nowhere, that I had a disease. And the second that moved from here to here, I'd heard it for 5 months. It seemed like this great weight just came off of me for the first time in my life. I felt as light as a feather. And the next thought was, now I can do something about it. Jerry said, Lee, I can't tell you what to do, but I'll show you what I did. And Jerry pointed us again to the book Alcoholics Anonymous and said that we had a program. Jerry said, well, you guys are going, there's not going to be 90 meetings in 90 days. You're going to have the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Jerry said, I can't promise you a good job. Maybe one of these days you'll get a good job. Maybe you won't. I can't promise you a wonderful relationship. Maybe one of these days you'll have a wonderful relationship. Maybe you won't. Jerry said, Lee, what we can promise you, that if you'll do the things, if you'll follow the suggestions contained within the book Alcoholics Anonymous, that you can have a relationship with a power greater than yourself. That can make your life mighty wonderful. I'm very happy to see you new people here.
and I want to encourage you. You know, I would go to Jerry and I'd say, Jerry, I'm a goner. I've tried everything. There's nothing that can help me. And if you feel that way tonight, if you've exhausted every avenue of hope, if there's no place left for you to turn, if you've used up everybody, every resource, if there's no place left for you to go, that makes you an excellent candidate for sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would go to Jerry and I'd say, Jerry, I'm not smart enough for this thing. Jerry, I've never even read a book. Let me assure you of this too. This deal is not dependent on individual skills or ability or intelligence that you may or may not have. This deal is for everybody. This is God's deal. We come in here just the way we are, of what we've got and a whole lot of what we don't have, and we do the best that we can do. And my best was just like that. But when I applied my best to the program in this book, God took this and He made this out of it. And I see Him do it over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. I can't explain it. I don't want to explain it. All I want to do is do it. Alcoholics Anonymous will not work for people who need it. It will not work for people who want it. Alcoholics Anonymous can only work for people who do it. And that's what I did. I got down to business with the plan of recovery in this book. And I did a fourth step. And I did a fifth step. And there were people that said, oh no, you don't want to do a fifth step. You're in jail, you know. I'm going to tell you, do a fifth step. The worst stuff in my life was a matter of public record. You know, you could pick up the newspaper and see my fifth step. You could turn it on Channel 9. What was hard to share was fear. To tell someone that I was afraid. To be vulnerable. But I did it. And I did the best I could at an eighth step. And I began my amends process. And I did what I could do. I'd like to tell you that when I went before the judge and explained to him how well I was doing in AA, he said, wow, that's wonderful. You can just go home right now. That did not happen for me. When I went before the judge, he said, we're going to give you a little something to help you clean up that mess you made. And I got my first 2 years of sobriety in a correctional facility. And I look back at that today, and God knew what He was doing. And I thank God for it today. I thank God for every day of it. When I got to my permanent camp, it had been 2 weeks since I'd been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, or 2 weeks since I'd had contact with a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they brought us all in. We got off the bus. We're all chained together on that bus. There was a guy there mopping the floor, and I said, hey, do you guys have AA here? He said, yeah, I think they've got a meeting tonight. I said, oh boy, you know. And they took us into this cell block that we were going to be in. They said, you men, you're all in period of orientation for the next 72 hours. The next 3 days, we're going to keep you here isolating population. You'll be in this period of orientation. We will not mix you with other people. Everything you do will be right in here. I said, boy, I want to go to that AA meeting tonight. And I watched one guy walked over a correctional officer, and he said, I need to call my attorney. I need to go to the telephone. He said, no. And I'd watch another guy. I'd walk over a correctional officer. He said, I need to go to the commissary. I need some cigarettes. He said, no. I said, boy, I want to go to that AA meeting tonight. I put my head down. I said, God, I'd sure like to go to that AA meeting tonight. I'm just going to put it in your hands. And I got up and I walked over to the correctional officer and I said, I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I need to go to that meeting tonight. He said, well, go ahead. God will give us what we need. You know that? We don't always get what we want, but God has always, always given me what I've needed. My job in this deal is to want what He wants for me. And I think back, you know, I think back at that, how that officer let me go to that meeting. You know, it's a nice cool evening there in Florida. I would think sometimes perhaps he thinks back. I can just see him right now. He's probably sitting on his porch swing, smoking a cigarette, reflecting back. I can just hear him thinking right now, why did I let that guy go? But I see stuff like that happen all the time around Alcoholics Anonymous. Boy, I got active in the meetings we had there in our camp. We had one big meeting a week. There's always 75 or 80 guys there. I said, boy, Alcoholics Anonymous is popular here. And then they had cake and coffee, and then the two outside female sponsors would come in. And it wasn't very long I figured out why the meetings were so popular. You know? Just good cake, I guess. And boy, they'd let me get involved and let me chair the meetings and stuff like that. And boy, sometimes no one would share and no one would want to say anything at all. And when that would happen, I'd just bust the book open and I'd start reading. And some of them didn't like that very much, but it helped me a lot. And I stayed sober. Myself and some guys got together, and what we wanted was another meeting. You could meet two, three, or four on that compound, but they don't allow numbers of people to congregate, and there's good reasons for that. So we wanted another meeting. I was down at Tom Eyes Correctional Conference a couple of years ago, and after 3 days of sharing and 3 days of discussion and panel meetings and listening to speakers and staying up late into the night talking and discussing this thing, two things came very clear to me. One, if a guy waits until he gets out to try to do something about changing his life, he will not make it. And I can tell you from personal experience that's true. The second thing is that more meetings are needed inside our facilities. And that's what we wanted. And myself and the guys, we got together and we said, well, let's get another meeting going, you know. And so we said, well, yeah, well, we'll find someone to help us with this, and then we'll be able to do this. Boy, and we asked everybody on the compound. They said, no, 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 no. And we would get together and we'd talk and we'd say, we've forgotten where we're at. We're convicts. We're just numbers. They'll never do anything like that for us. And one of the guys said, hey, well, let's just pray about it. And you know, we don't know what prayer is. We only knew that it is. And we started praying about it. You know, we prayed and prayed. You know, God, we'd sure like to have this meeting. And a couple of months later, they came to us and said, you know, we've got a night. There's nothing going on. And if you guys still want to have that meeting, you can have that meeting. I said, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Boy, and we had our meeting. And I got some books and found a room and got some chips and some pamphlets. Got in there and straightened the chairs. I named the meeting. Boy, I kind of felt like I was in charge. Boy, we had our first meeting, and I was chairing the meeting. Everybody, they were talking and sharing. One guy said something. I said, you can't say that here. That's against tradition. He said, well, which one? I said, I don't know. It's got to be against one of them. Boy, he jumped over the table on me and wanted to fire me up. It was a mess. It was a mess. And all the next week, I just prayed and prayed. I said, oh, God, what am I going to do? I can't just turn this meeting over to those idiots. They'll ruin it, you know. I prayed and prayed about it. Next week, I went to my meeting. I was standing there in the doorway thinking, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And some of the guys came over to me and said, Lee, we've talked about it, and we've decided that if you'll sit right over there and be quiet, we'll let you stay. And I stayed quiet. And it went okay, you know. It was no big deal. And at that time, in my life, there's nothing on this earth that meant more to me than that hour and those men, and that we could be together. Let me tell you what happened to me as a result of putting into practice a program described in the pages of this book and being available to serve in Alcoholics Anonymous any way I could. On Saturday mornings, the compound was real quiet. Most of the guys would sleep in. And that was an opportunity for me to get up and get out on that yard really early. And I could have a little privacy and I could practice my 11th step. I prayed every day. But this was my one opportunity of the week to really put this thing into practice. And I was out there one Saturday morning. And I could feel the warmth of the sun on my face. And I could feel the breeze. And I could hear the birds. And I was out there, I was just talking to God. And I realized that I was happy. And for the first time in my life, I knew that my life was really going somewhere. And that it was okay to be me. I mean, I was in prison. And I felt like $1 million. And you're not supposed to feel that way in prison. You're supposed to be discouraged. You're supposed to be filled with despair. You're supposed to know there is no hope. You're supposed to be lost. You're supposed to be alone. You're supposed to be filled with fear and filled with hate. But my roots had grasped new soil. And inside of me there was a willingness to believe that there was a power greater than me that was guiding my life and taking me to something better. I was not happy to be in prison. But I found happiness in the midst of prison because He was with me. God does not give us pain, suffering, or sorrow. God gives us the strength to endure it, no matter what. And Vicki, I think you're as fine of example of that as I've ever seen in Alcoholics Anonymous. They suggested that the day you get out, you go straight to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the day I got out, two men that I'd been locked up with picked me up. And that's what we did. And we got to that meeting, I felt like I had prison written across my forehead. I was scared to death. And we went into the meeting. They were sitting in a small circle. And everyone was sharing. And it became my turn to share. I put my head down. I said, I just got out of jail. I couldn't even say prison. And the guy's chairing the meeting, he said, well, we're glad you're out of jail. And if you really mean business about doing something about changing your life and not drinking, you've come to the right place. You didn't care where I'd been or what I'd done. All you cared about was what I was willing to do about my recovery and how you could help me. And that's all I've ever found in Alcoholics Anonymous, was people that wanted to help me no matter what. I've never been asked to leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never been told that I was too bad that I wouldn't make it here. I've always heard, Lee, if you'll do it, it'll work for you. If you put forth the action necessary, it'll work for you. And if you don't drink today, you'll never have to take another drink, because it's always today. And if you don't drink, you can't get drunk. I went to 110 meetings my first 90 days out, 100 the next 90, and 90 the next 90, and I just lived in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And people would come by and pick me up and take me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and take me into their homes and feed me dinner. A man had two coats, and that man gave me a coat. And everybody got around me and just tried to make sure I had the best opportunity at having this deal as I could have. You know what I did? I caused trouble immediately. I did the best I could do. And that's what it was. I was only out a couple of weeks, and then we were in the meeting. We're closing the meeting, Lord's Prayer, and I felt this little tiny hand slip itself into mine. And whoa, boy, I felt something I hadn't felt in a while. And now everybody knows that after the meeting, you're supposed to go to the Golden Lamb for coffee. You know, everybody knows that. But this night, this woman and I, we went someplace else. And I was so dumb that I did not realize that just anything could happen if a man and a woman went off together alone. And that evening, anything happened, you know. And so the next day I woke up, I had this smile on my face. I couldn't get it off no matter what. And I, you know, I went to work and I, you know, did all my business. I got to the meeting that evening. I got there just as they were saying the Serenity Prayer. I was very excited, you know. And boy, we said the Serenity Prayer. I raised my head up and there was that woman. I saw her, you know, way down at the other end. There's 30 people around two big tables. And I saw her. I said, there she is. Oh, boy. And I looked, I said, she's crying. She's upset. Something must have happened today to upset her. Because I was just with her last night and everything was great, you know. They said, does anyone have anything to share? And she said, oh, I feel like I've been used. I said, oh, you know what I said. She said, I feel like I've been used by him. I said, oh my God, they're gonna throw me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've blown it now. They'll never let me come back. There was a little old-timer there by the name of Elise, looked over at her and said, honey, if you don't like the way it feels, don't ever do it again. And probably saved my life, you know. I don't think I could have ever come back. After the meeting, a guy from the halfway house came over to me and said, Lee, how'd that feel? I said, boy, that didn't feel very good at all, you know. He said, guess what? if you don't ever do that again, you'll never have to feel that way again. Boy, I wish I'd gotten that lesson the first time. After the meeting, Elise came over to me. You know, they know when they've got you. And handed me the keys and said, next week, you open up. And boy, you know, she gave me a little something to do other than what I was doing. And I was scared to death. I said, oh, my God, I've got to get there early. I'm going to have to make the coffee. You know, and boy, I got there really early the next week and, you know, did everything. It came off okay and, you know, it was all right. And, you know, when they give you these little jobs around here, if you do pretty good, guess what? They'll give you other jobs and other jobs and other jobs and other jobs. And boy, that's been my experience in service in Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard Betty S. share a poem down in South Florida that really just sums up my service career. My child helped me snip beans today. She kept the bad and threw the good away. I think how patient God must be when I help him the way she helps me. I've stayed sober, and I've always had a job in Alcoholics Anonymous. They suggested a sponsor. I looked around the room. Everybody else had one. Looked like the popular thing to do. I certainly wanted to be popular. So I asked this fellow named Butch. Don't ever ask anybody named Butch to be your sponsor. It might be him. Don't ever ask anybody named Butch or Killer to be your sponsor. Because boy, this guy was something else. I know I went to him one time. I thought he ought to loan me a little money. He told me to shut up. He said I was stupid. He said, get in there in the meeting and sit down on the front row. That's where the stupid people sit. No offense. One time I went to Butch. I had some complaints. I said, I'll write these complaints down, and I'll go and share them with Butch. Boy, and I wrote them down, you know. I found Butch, and I ran over to him and said, Butch, I want to show you this. I've done a lot of work, you know. And I want you to look at this. And I said, look at this. I don't like this, and 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 this stinks. And boy, what do you think about that? He goes, wow, you're not very happy with what you have here. I said, no, I'm not happy with this. He goes, well, maybe you ought to go get drunk. See how you like that. I said, boy, I don't want to get drunk. He said, well, you're not very happy with what you have. You'll probably get drunk. So I got happy. I said, maybe this stuff isn't as bad as I thought, you know. And for me, gratitude is the hinge on which the gate of sobriety swings. I have never seen a grateful alcoholic get drunk. And never, ever have I seen a person fail that thoroughly enjoyed this path. And boy, what a path do we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You could never have explained to me what I was going to find when I came in here to be with you. I didn't know if I wanted what you had. All I knew is I didn't want what I had. September the 12th, 1986, I was released from the penitentiary for what I know can be the last time. March the 30th, 1992, Division of Parole and Pardons released me 15 and a half years early after having spent 17 and a half years of my life in the correction system, either inside or on some kind of paper waiting to go back, knowing I was going to go back, knowing that was going to be my life. And I brought nothing here with me that could have produced that for me. I came here with a shoebox. That's what I brought with me when I came here. I came here with a shoebox, with one change of underwear, one change of socks, a few letters, and some pencils, and a book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I came with. But everything in life that I needed to have any success at all met me at the door when I came here to be with you. I had 11 jobs the first 18 months that I was out. I wasn't any better at that sober than I was drunk. Every job I had one thing really wrong with it. They wanted me to work. And I was having a terrible time. And I'd go to these meetings. These guys, they don't give you any breaks at all. They really mistreat you, you know. I'd walk in the meeting. They just immediately, have you got a job, you know. They wouldn't give me any grace at all, boy. And just put all this pressure on me. I'm going to get a job, you know. I was going in the jail meeting late one afternoon. And a guy was walking out of the meeting, and I was talking with him, and he handed me a business card and said, call this guy tomorrow, you know. I'll put in a good word for you, you know. And I said, okay, you know. And later that night, I went to my meeting. And they said, have you got a job, you know, and I showed them this card. Look at this. Maybe I'll get this job, you know. Yeah, get a job. So the next morning, I call this guy. And he said, yes, we need some people immediately. Come down here tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Bring your resume. Click. I said, resume? What am I going to put on some kind of resume? You know, bad, big mistake, you know. You know, state prison, state prison, state prison. Man, I can't do that. You know, this is terrible, you know. And I went to my meeting that night, and they said, did you call that fella? I said, yes, I called him. Big mistake. He wanted a resume, you know. And they said, well, we think you ought to go down there and talk to that guy. We think you ought to go down there and tell him the truth. I said, I can't do that, you know. They said, they suggested to me that they might not even want to bother with me anymore if I wasn't willing to go down there. I went home that night and I just started praying. I said, God, what am I going to do? You know, this is horrible. I mean, you know, I can't go down to this place. I mean, this is going to be awful. You know, and I can't go down. There's nobody to go with me. You know, you're going to have to go with me. If I'm going, you're going with me. You know, and I got up the next morning. I said, okay, God, we're going down to this place. We're not going to be there very long, you know. We went in this guy's office, and he was really busy. He had a phone in each hand, hung those phones up and said, sit down over there. I sat down. He goes, where's your resume? I said, I don't have a resume. He goes, no big deal. Do you have any experience in sales? And the moment he said that, it was like a light went off in my mind. I said, well, yeah. I've sold microwaves and stereos and cars and boats and guns and tools and jewelry. And he goes, wow, you got a lot of experience. Think I can get you a start tomorrow? He said, yeah. You know, I said, yeah, man. I sold that guy's product like popcorn. You didn't have to sneak down the alley with it and keep it covered up with a blanket, hide it in the trunk of your car. You just walk up to anybody, you know? And I don't think God minds it at all that we have a little something and do pretty good here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Listen to this. I become a regular guy. I have a job. I have a car. I have clothes. I live somewhere. I was down in an intergroup office one day, and they asked me if I wanted to be on the service committee. I said, yeah, you know, I volunteered for the service committee. After a year on the service committee, I said, boy, this is important. I must be important, you know. This is valuable. I have value. Boy, I felt so good about myself. I said, I'll go back to school. I went back to school and got an education. I heard a woman in a meeting once. She was sharing. She said, I love what I do so much that this morning I woke up at 4 o'clock and I just laid there and I couldn't think about anything else but just going to work, going to work, going to work. I was so excited I couldn't go back to sleep. I said, God. I don't feel that way, you know. She loves what she does so much she can't even sleep. And I was praying about that. I said, God, isn't there anything like that for me? I mean, what's wrong with me? You know, of course, I was grateful to have a job and be able to work and pay my bills and buy tires, you know, and stuff like that. So I started praying. You know, I heard early in my sobriety, they said, Lee, if you take care of God's business, God will take care of your business. So I said, well, God, I was praying about this. I said, I don't know what to do. I'll just start working with all these new guys. I'll even work with the ones with blonde hair, you know. I'll take any job in AA I can get. I'll take every job in AA that's appropriate, you know. I'll do whatever it takes. You know, I just got really busy in AA. And it's my experience that if you'll take care of God's business, He'll give you a business. Because He did that for me. And I love what I do today. And it's a tremendous, tremendous, tremendous blessing. It's like waking up and being on vacation every day. Sometimes I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And I'm so excited about going to work that I just lay there. And it's good. It's good. God is good. God is good. God has been real, real good to me. I'm going to close. Before I do, I want to share a little bit about my ninth step. Several areas of the program people have a lot of trouble with, especially new folks. And one area is this God thing. We have a lot of trouble with God here. Boy, I like what Dr. Bob says about that. If you are an atheist or agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which may keep you from accepting what we have in this book, I feel sorry for you. It's a pretty easy door that we need to walk through when you can come up with your own conception. Anything you want. You can't have it your way in this deal anywhere but that one way. You can have it your way. Anything that you're willing to believe is good enough, but you have to believe something or be willing to. Another area the guys I work with have trouble is the fifth step. It's a difficult thing to really get down. They have trouble with the fourth step because they don't want to do the fifth step. And I thank God that Earl's here, who will go into detail about that tomorrow. Don't miss that meeting tomorrow, you new people. That's a law. That's a rule. Be here when Earl speaks. That's one of those rules here we don't have. That's a suggestion. You know, when I did my first fifth step, I can't say that I really identified any specific defects of character or anything like that. But there are two places in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that talks about getting drunk again. And neither one of those is we don't go to enough meetings. But I would suggest you go to a whole lot of meetings. One's on bottom page 14 where in Bill's story where it says we fail to perfect and enlarge our spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others. We will not survive. We will not survive the certain, not uncertain, trials and low spots ahead. If we do not work, we will drink. And the other place it talks about getting drunk again is in the fifth step on page 73. And it says, time after time, newcomers will want to keep to themselves some certain facts about their life. And invariably they get drunk. The one thing that I did accomplish in that first fifth step, all my life, I was like two Lees. I had one Lee on the outside and another Lee on the inside that nobody ever got to see. Nobody got to see that. It was a secret Lee. After I did my first step, my fifth step for the first time in my life, I wasn't two halves anymore. I was one whole for the first time in my life. Another area a lot of people have a lot of trouble is, of course, the ninth step. And I wasn't any different than anybody else. And my sponsor, he didn't let me lay around very long at all. He helped me do an eighth step list when I was out, you know, and he said, Lee, you'll never stay sober unless you get down to business with this ninth step. You know, and I would look at that list and I'd say, oh, my God, how am I ever going to repay whole communities or cities for the harm that I've caused? And, you know, he just gave me the boot and said, you get out there and you do it, you know, really rough with me. And one day I just grabbed the bull by the horns and I got out there and, you know, just tried to clean up the mess I'd made. You know, I'd look at that list and, you know, I'd say, I can't go to my father. My father's dead. I couldn't go to my father. My father had been killed. You know, and in the ninth step it says there's people that we cannot see. They're in our book. And we'd see them if we could, but we can't see them. And what we do is we write them an honest letter. And what I did, well, I wrote my dad an honest letter. Now, you know, I would sit and think about my father, and I wouldn't have good thoughts about my father. It was like, I felt like I'd been done wrong or something like that when I'd think of my dad. But I went to my dad's grave, and I read the letter. And, you know, when I'm in Arkansas and I'm in that area, I would go and visit my father's grave, and I'll talk to my father, you know, just as if he's sitting right there. And, you know, where at one time I had these thoughts that weren't good thoughts about my dad. You know, when I think of my dad today, as a result of just doing what's in the book, you know, I remember my father. I remember him as a small child. My dad would get with me and get me on my knees by my bed and try to teach me how to pray, you know. And I think of that and I think, wow, I had a great dad. What a great father I had that he would try to do that with me. And I feel very fortunate to have had the father that I had today. Another area was I'd committed a lot of crimes. I'd done so many crimes. There was no way of ever trying to go back and do anything about this. And in the book, boy, it talks about I went to my sponsor, I said, look here, you know, it says maybe we need to go back to jail. We face jail, you know. And he referred me to a guy who had been sober a long, long, long time, you know. And I went and talked to old Charlie L., who passed on a couple years ago with 52 years of sobriety. And Charlie and I, we looked at this, and Charlie said, you know, Lee, I don't think it's necessary. I don't think God needs you to go back to jail. And there's other ways to clean this stuff up. And what I did, you know, I went to the board, you know, I looked on the board. There was a guy who had his name up there. He wanted to go to meetings. He just needed a ride. And I started picking up Saul and taking Saul to meetings. Now, on Saul's last drunk, he lost both his legs. That's what happened to him the last time he took a drink. And what you do is you go and you pick Saul up and you put him in the front seat. You get the wheelchair, you put it in the trunk. And then you go to the meeting and you reverse that. Get him out, put him in the wheelchair and take him in the meeting. Now, before I first started doing that, I said, boy, this is very difficult. I don't know about this. But after 30 days, I said, that became the richest part of my life. I couldn't wait to get over there and pick that guy up. And after 9 months, I mean, it's like you had to get over there really early to pick him up. You know, everybody was over there to pick him up. You wanted to pick him up, you had to get there early, you know. And it was the greatest thing. We'd take him in these meetings, and they'd bust the book open, read that third chapter, We Are Like Men Who Have Lost Our Legs. All the new people would lean over and look at Saul, you know. He'd share the same thing every week. Let me tell you what happened to me last time I took a drink, you know. And what a powerful, powerful message that guy had. There's no telling how many people he saved with it. I come from a very large family. And, of course, my family were on my list. After I'd been out of prison 1 year, I flew into Arkansas to visit my grandparents. And Saturday, I'd fly out on a Friday. Saturday morning, I'd get up. And I'd go out in the community and try to make amends. You know, I'd go to a place I used to work, I'd destroy, you know, or steal from or something like that. In the afternoons, I'd visit my older relatives who couldn't get out, my handicapped cousin. And on Sunday morning, I'd give my grandparents all day. After about 3 years, I would fly in, I'd do that, do it again, you know, Saturday, make a few amends, visit my older relatives who couldn't get out, Saturday night, go to a meeting. Sunday morning, an aunt would call or an uncle would come by. I'd been out for 7 years. I was 10 years sober. I'd, you know... And I came in on a Friday. Saturday morning I got up. I visited my older relatives that couldn't get out, my handicapped cousin. Saturday night I went to a meeting. On Sunday morning, 40 members of my family came over to my grandparents' house to be with me. One of my uncles came over to me and said, Lee, there's just something about you that makes people want to be together. And I thought to myself, I know what it is. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. I really appreciate what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. I cannot fit AA into my life. AA is my life. Sometimes I've said that and people come to me and say, well, boy, it's not my life. I came here so I could have a life. I just say, good for you. That's not what I want. I want this. And I want more of this. And I want to go anywhere Alcoholics Anonymous can take me. I'm going to close with a story. It's one I heard that helped me a lot with this higher power thing for you new people. In 1989 in Armenia, a father walked his son to school. He took him to the steps of the school and walked several blocks to where he was working. That day in Armenia, they had an earthquake. And they did not build buildings in Armenia the way they build them out in California where Karen lives. They built them out of rock and stone and brick. And that city was absolutely destroyed. And that father miraculously drug himself out of the rubble of the building that he was in and ran those blocks to where that school had been. Past fires, emergency vehicles, people screaming. He got to the school and it was just a pile of stone. And he ran to the top of the pile and he was throwing rocks and throwing bricks and screaming out his son's name, Armand, 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 Armand. And people would come to him and say, you're bleeding, let us bandage you. You're in shock, let us help you. And he'd say, help me find my son, help me find my son. And they'd say, we can't help him, he's delirious. And they'd go help someone else. 36 hours later, he was still standing there, throwing rocks and throwing bricks and screaming out his son's name. After 36 hours, he heard something. He said, Armand, is it you? He heard, yes, Father, it's me. He said, son, are you all right? He heard, yes, Father, I'm all right. There are 13 of us in here. I told them that if my father is alive, he will not rest until he saves me. And after he helps me, he'll help you too. You new people, I've got real good news. Here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a father. In the fifth chapter, Bill wrote, He is the Father, we are His children. In the closing of Dr. Bob's story, Dr. Bob wrote, Your Heavenly Father will never let you down. Here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you have a heavenly spiritual Father who will not rest until He saves you. He will not rest until He reaches you. And after He's helped you, He's going to use you to help somebody else. I love all of you. And thank you for helping me stay sober today.